get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Gina.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you all for joining us. Thanks for listening, liking, subscribing, sharing, doing all that social media stuff that gets the word out about us and about the National Coast Guard Museum. We really appreciate it. Hey, who I've got on the line today? Gina, obviously. Hi, Gina.
Hello.
We're still working on our intro. I told her that we got to change up the that initial thank you. Even though we thank you, we got to come up with something cool. We're just talking about the Ryder Cup, and we did learn that Gina dates a golf pro, or at least did. And
I did. He was my high school boyfriend, which obviously great intro into who we've got on the show tonight.
For sure. He actually introduced or made the introductions for Gina so that we could get the guests on tonight. And just after talking with him for a few minutes, I'm very stoked to have him on the show.
Thank you.
Who we have, Dr. Lee Fanning, that's right, an MD tonight. Born in Philadelphia, raised in Shelby, North Carolina, near Charlotte. Went to Davidson College and then the University of Virginia Medical School. Joined the U.S. Public Health Service in 1971. And had a list of options of where to go. There was a hazardous duty assignment in San Francisco. He picked up on that and ended up as a lieutenant in the Coast Guard, serving as a flight surgeon on the West Coast. Area responsibility, told us, extended pretty much from Oregon to the tip of Baja. Did a two-year tour with the health service, getting out as a lieutenant commander. Went on to the University of Wisconsin. Then a two-year fellowship of infectious disease at University of Vermont. And has since worked in practice in the University of Massachusetts and in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I'm sure a slew of other places, and just recently retired. So, Dr. Fanning, welcome to the show, sir.
Well, thank you. And I have to correct one thing. I'm not Gina's old boyfriend.
Yes. New boyfriend? Did we miss that one?
No. We entered. Tyler Ramsey. Shout out to Tyler Ramsey, a man among men who was my high school boyfriend. Introduced. He's a golf pro at Lee's Golf Club. So he introduced me and said, "Hey, this guy has an amazing story. Was in the Coast Guard." So he kind of put us as the podcast onto Lee's story. So I'm really happy that we're able to make it happen. And another thing is I'm so happy we finally get an aviator, or kind of an aviator, on the show. I've been doing a lot of boat stuff, and I think, you know, I'm a little biased, so I'm excited to hear these stories coming up. But yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to represent the Coast Guard aviation story to you. And I was inducted into the Coast Guard right after my internship, and to be honest with you, I was a little bit cocky when I finished my internship, and I thought I was ready for anything, but I failed to listen to the recruiters statement about it being a hazardous duty station, and I went up out with a bit of a naive attitude about the Coast Guard. And I'll just jump right into the story of the first day I arrived at the Coast Guard Air Station in San Francisco. I flew in, I landed, I actually got a ride over to the base from someone who was an electrician at the San Francisco airport but had been in the Coast Guard, and he offered me a ride. So I got off, and as I got out of the car, he wished me luck, and I said, what do you mean, why are you wishing me luck? And he said, well, I think you're going to need a doc. And I started thinking about what hazardous duty meant at that time, and arrived at the base and went to the BOQ to find a room and to sign in, and decided to go up to the bar upstairs and introduce myself to the pilots.
Typical doctor, and straight to the bar. Or aviator, I don't know, one of the two.
Well, I ordered a beer, but I never got to drink it because as I was drinking it, as I started to drink it, the loudspeaker came on, and there had been an emergency declared by a 747, which was had taken off and apparently was overloaded and hit the landing lights on takeoff. And one of the steel girders in the landing lights that were out over the bay actually went through the fuselage of the plane, decompressed it, injured the right landing gear, completely demolished that, and also interfered with the hydraulics of the plane. So the captain declared an emergency after taking off and asked permission to dump fuel because they needed to make an emergency landing. I think the pilot gave him about 30 minutes to prepare for that. And the next thing I know, a corpsman runs in and asks if the new doc is there. And I kind of half raised my hand. And he had a flight suit, pair of boots, Nomex gloves, and a helmet. And he said, put these on, doc. We got to get out of here. So I went into the restroom, put them on. I realized the boot size was two sizes too big. The gloves were one size too big. And when I put on the flight suit, it was also too big. So by the time I got my helmet on, I looked like I was ready for a Halloween party, but had to put on a pretty serious face because the corpsman ran me out to a helicopter. I had never been on a helicopter in my life. And you could tell the helicopter was just ready to take off. It was shaking, and it was like a Mixmaster. It was ready to go. And I got on board the helicopter. They plugged me into the intercom, and I heard the story that the 747 was coming in for a crash landing. It was there was preparation. There were plenty of ambulances there. And in the helicopter, I found out that I, fresh out of my internship, was in charge of triage for the crash landing. This was about four levels above my pay grade at the time. And I was kind of shaking. I was shaking in those big boots, to be honest with you. And I wasn't quite sure how I was going to handle it. The 747 came in, and you could hear the pilot, very professional voice, sounded like he had a very positive attitude about the crash landing. And when he hit, he had to land so that the starboard bogey on the plane was off the ground, and he was landing basically on the front wheel. The left bogey, and when he landed, the left tires blew out, and a fire started, and there was smoke billowing from the plane. It hit on the runway. I believe it was 28 right at San Francisco. Hit on the runway, skidded immediately off the runway, which fortunately the tarmac dust put out the fire. But when the plane came to rest after a fairly long skid on the tarmac, the front of the plane tilted up, and the tip of the plane, the tail, kicked back. And so the front of the plane was like 3 to 4 stories off the ground. And that was the first time in 747 history that one had actually tipped back after crashing. what it did is when the chutes, the emergency chutes came out, the ones in the front were 15 to 18 feet off the ground. And I could see this out of the helicopter as the people started coming down the chutes, that some of them were airborne and landing on the tarmac from about 15 feet up. And I told the pilot they needed to let the corpsman and I off because we were going to have to deal with those injuries, plus the ones that occurred on the plane. And they occurred on the plane because the steel strut came through the fuselage and actually impaled two of the passengers. One lost his leg, and the other one was hit in the shoulder by a piece of steel. So there were injuries on the plane as well when it crash-landed, because when it first hit, it bounced about 60 feet off the ground before coming back down and blowing out the tires. So there were injuries from that as well. So we were dealing with injuries from the plane and the crash. And we were also dealing with injuries on the outside. And part of my problem was a lot of there did not seem to be enough training prior to this plane crash. And what was happening is the ambulance EMTs were taking people off in ambulances for things like sprained ankles and sprained wrists. And I had to stop that because a lot of more seriously injured people were being ignored. So the Corps and I basically started triaging, and we did it by people who were the most injured, who looked like they needed help first, would get on an ambulance, or we were going to put them on the helicopter and take them to the local hospitals. So I'll be honest with you, it's kind of like going into a football game and being really nervous. The first few minutes, I wasn't quite sure how to handle it. But as soon as I started working, some of my emergency training started roaring back, and I started realizing how we had to get the most injured onto the helicopter to go to a local hospital, and the others could be put in ambulances. And to be honest with you, I got into some arguments with the ambulance drivers because I probably looked like a teenager to them in the flight suit and the helmet, and they didn't really want to take me seriously. So I tried real hard to come up with a military voice, which I was able to impersonate because I had no military training. And my day with the corpsman, who we kind of bonded immediately, his name was David Thompson. He was an HM1, and we worked for about 2 hours getting people off to the hospital, and that was my first day. When I got back to the base and we kind of were, David asked me to help him write up reports on what we'd done for the CO of the base. And I was told by one of the duty officers after I got back to the base that I hadn't signed in yet. So the Coast Guard actually was not going to recognize what I had done because I was doing it as a civilian, not as a signed in officer. So the next day I had a talk with the captain, and I had signed in officially, and he said they weren't going to tell anybody that I really wasn't officially a flight surgeon the day before if I didn't tell anybody. But they kind of kept it, to be honest with you, rather quiet because I really was not an official member of the team yet. So
secret's out now, Lee.
Yes. So that was my first day, and I will say it was a trial by fire. And I really haven't worried about first days with any of my other occupational new jobs after that. So it was a very interesting and fulfilling day. None of the patients died. Everyone did well. We had a couple of real serious injuries, but we were able to get everybody off the plane. There was no fire. The ones that were injured badly were sent to the University of California Hospital in San Francisco, and a lot of the others went to local hospitals in Burlingame and in San Mateo.
Wow. How many people were on the plane?
It was a full load. So a 747 at that time, I would imagine it was close to 300 people.
Wow.
So it was a lot of people. It was a lot of noise. You felt like you were, until the jet engines, were cut off, and there was some silence that, but with the sirens and the people screaming and people are all around talking and yelling, it was quite a scene. It really was. Nothing that I had any expectations of when I arrived at the base.
How long did that day last for you? How long, I can imagine that many people getting evacuated. I mean, how long did that day last for you?
He and I worked really hard for about 2 hours on the people who were really needed to be seen and gotten out of there fast. You know, we started IVs. We put them in Trendelenburg position, which is to get their legs up because they might be in shock. We put air splints on people who looked like they had fractures of ankles or injured knees. But the entire process probably took about 8 hours, and by the time we were finished, it was close to midnight. And I hadn't called my parents to tell them, but they were back on East Coast time, and I didn't want to call them at 3 o'clock in the morning. So the next morning, the phone rings. It was my father, and he said something. There was a crash at San Francisco Airport, and he knew I was arriving there. And he said, "You weren't involved in that, were you, son?"
Little do you know. I love that story, Lee. What a great it just speaks to the Coast Guard, I think, because you never know. Every day something different.
Exactly.
Could be day one. Yeah, I love it.
I mean, the Coast Guard really, because we're so small and we do so much with so little, we really be thrown into anything at any time. So, yeah.
Yes, I was always amazed at the teamwork of the Coast Guard, and I think that's what I took from the military, as I learned how to be a doctor, but at the same time, be a member of the team, a member with a pilot and a co-pilot and an air crewman and the corpsman, and all working together, and usually in bad weather. It was never ideal, or they wouldn't have asked us to come. You know, it wasn't an ambulance run. We were looking at things that were in bad weather often, and storms, and we had really serious medical conditions that we're dealing with. And Dave Thompson and I learned to work together. We learned to put our emergency kits together so that we could get to things fast. We had a surgical kit. We had a medical kit for heart attacks and things like that. And we had
the baby delivery kit. Did you have that one?
Did we have what?
The baby delivery kit.
The
pediatric kit, is that what you call it?
But actually, it didn't involve the Coast Guard, so I'm not going to go there. Yeah, we were ready for that, too, although neither Dave nor I had a lot of experience with that.
See, that's funny, because there's definitely a lot of Coast Guard stories floating around of, that's the first sight of a crying baby is a guy in a blue uniform. I feel bad for him, but somehow they make it out.
Yep, they do.
Well, therapy, I'm sure.
Doc, maybe you can tell us about, so you're the first flight surgeon, first public health service officer that we've had on the show. And it's interesting to me, too, because I've been involved in a few projects where we've looked at line of duty deaths, and particularly during World War II, there were a few names that were missing from the roles that were actually public health service officers assigned to the Coast Guard. So I wonder if we dive into your next one, and I'm definitely going to intro it with that most dangerous, daring, and epic sea story line. But what does the public health service do? How did you get involved? And how did the tours work?
The public health service at the time that I went into it was mainly doing the Indian Health Service, Public Health Service hospitals. And when I went into the Coast Guard, it was an alternative to going to Vietnam, because I thought my training would be better served and in the direction that I wanted to go is if I went into the Public Health Service as an alternative. But what I didn't realize is when I applied, all of those other jobs that I just mentioned were all filled up, because it was the biggest draft they ever had for doctors. So when I called the public health service, all those jobs were filled, and he said that he had a public health service slash Coast Guard billet for me. And I asked him where, and he said the Arctic, the Antarctic, and Southeast Asia. And I said, boy, those don't sound like something I was looking for. Don't you have something else? And he said, well, we do have a hazardous duty station in Traverse City, Michigan, and in San Francisco. And I'd been to San Francisco on vacation with my parents. And I said, without thinking of what hazardous duty meant, I said, I'll take it. And he said, oh, you've made the right choice, Doc. And I said, explain hazardous duty to me. And he said, well, you like to fly, don't you? And I said, yeah, I love to fly. And he said, you're going to love it. And the next thing I heard, the phone clicked, and he was gone.
Nice. And is that all so it takes is a phone call? A phone call to enlist or to commission through public health service?
Yeah, I had to first enlist through the public health service, and then they assigned me to the Coast Guard.
Yep.
So my uniform was always a little bit confusing to people because it had a public health service device on it and Coast Guard insignia on it. So I was always a little confusing to some people, but it really, for me, turned out to be the best choice I could have made. And I learned, I got more from it than I gave to the Coast Guard. I really appreciated my 2 years in the service, and it was wonderful. It was a wonderful learning experience for me.
Awesome. I totally echo that. I think most people that serve probably echo that. What about as a flight surgeon? What particularly like was your job as a flight surgeon? What was the, if I was to read about in the paper, or the job description somewhere, what do you think it would say?
Well, in those days, the flight surgeon actually was hoisted down to any emergency that occurred along with the corpsman. I think today there's a lot of consulting that the flight surgeon does. I think probably in Alaska, the flight surgeons still probably are hoisted down in certain emergencies, but they've really trained a lot of physician assistant type, EMT type personnel to be the active hoist people to go down to emergencies, and then the doctor over the radio gives them consultation if they need it. And also with the rescue personnel who actually are the Coast Guard personnel who jump in the water to save people, the Coast Guard's really changed. The modern Coast Guard has changed a lot. And when I was it was me and the corpsman and the air crewman. And sometimes I actually had to work the hoist in certain rescues. So I became an air crewman, trained. And so I really felt like I was a member of the team. And I think the hardest part for me is I was afraid of heights. And so I had a hard time at the beginning until I could actually just become more used to it. I never got over the fear of heights, but I was able to learn how to control the fear of heights, because by the time you got out there hanging on the hoist, hanging on the end of that cable, trying to get yourself onto a ship in a 40 or 50 mile an hour wind and waves that were 8 to 10 feet high, and you needed to get on there before the weather got worse, it was exciting. It frightened you. You had a fear for your life sometimes, but I did learn to control my fear of heights. And but I will tell you, the highest step ladder we have in our house now is only 3 stairs.
So. That's good.
I didn't get over it completely.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, Doc, that leads us into our next one. I'm going to intro this one for you, because I do think that this is going to be your most dangerous. But could you go ahead, since you shared your first, could you share with us your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story?
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
First of all, there are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
And these exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum. And here's our favorite 5.
For as little as $5 a month, you can become a plank owner and support the construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
One to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com.
The most dangerous one that I had was actually the last rescue that I made. And I had a history in my career of having really unusual first days and kind of very unusual last days, no matter what I did. And the last day was, I had to get my 4 hours of flight time because it had been a slow month. It was June of 1973. And we went out on oil patrol. And about 3 hours into the oil patrol, we got a call that a young man had fallen off something called Devil's Canyon, which was probably about 25 or 30 miles south of the base. It was on the coast, and it was an area where there were cliffs, and a young man had been hiking and had fallen down off a cliff and had been severely injured. And the sheriff's department reached him but could not safely get him off because what he was on was shale and it was very slippery. And that's why he fell so badly and fell so far. He had, if I remember correctly, had a compound fracture of his leg, had broken his collarbone, he had a head injury, and he was not responsive. So they called us, and the pilot, who was Lieutenant Ron Simons, said that we were going to get off of the oil patrol and go to it and try and get me and the corpsman down. But he said it was going to be very difficult because there were 100-foot ponderosa pines up and down the canyon and near where Devil's Canyon was. They were on the sides of the canyon where the shale was not. And if you can picture this, a helicopter coming down into 100-foot ponderosas with a 100-foot cable, and that was the length of the cable. And there wasn't quite enough to get down safely, so the pilot actually had to come down into the trees. And here I am and the air crewman looking out, and we could actually see pine boughs beside us. And the air crewman had to help the pilot get as far down as he could and had to keep looking at the tail rotor to make sure that the tail rotor didn't hit any of the pine boughs. So,
Gina, I'm sorry.
We got down.
Yeah, that's, I'm having flashbacks.
I know, Gina, I was scared for you there for a second.
I know, I'm flashing back. Don't mind me.
Yeah, sorry, I'm Doc. I just, I could hear Gina over there like, oh man, I know how this goes.
I'm having a panic attack over here. Talking about helicopters and pine trees and yeesh.
So the next thing he says to me is, Doc, we're low on fuel. We got to get you down fast. So I get into the, get into the donut. Don't get into the basket because you might get hung up in the basket. And if you get caught in one of the trees, we're going to have to shear the cable. And you're not going to make it if that happens. So I got into the donut, started down. It was really windy, so I started spinning. And between spinning and my fear of heights, I got dizzy, I got nauseated, I started getting headache, and I kind of had to just pull myself together as I was going down because I knew it was going to be a tough landing. And sure enough, I barely was able to get my toes on the ground because there was no cable lift. And so I kind of let myself out of the donut, landed on the shale, and started sliding down the mountain. And I was lucky because there were a couple of really sickly looking roots sticking out of the shale. And as I was sliding by, I was able to grab one and stop myself from sliding. And I didn't realize it, but I looked down and there was a 200-foot chasm below the end of the shale. So I tried getting the radio out and informing the HM1 Thompson that he was going to have to be careful. Thompson weighed about 210 pounds. I weighed about 150 pounds. And I knew he was going to have a tougher time if he hit the shale. So he's already out. I don't think he gets my message on the radio because all I could hear was static. The radios were not great. And so I hit it against the ground a couple of times. That's the only electronics I knew. And it did work. And I did get the co-pilot, but it was too late to tell Thompson about the shale. So what I did is I kind of positioned myself as to where he was going to come down. And when he hit, 200 pounds started coming down like a slalom sled. And I was able to grab his uniform. And fortunately, he didn't slide that far before I got him. But he kind of slammed into me, and we both kind of got a little, you know, we kind of fell on the shale and were a little woozy. But we were able to get up. The sheriff's department threw down a rope to us and pulled us up. And when we got up there, the guy was really in bad shape. He was still unconscious. His blood pressure was low. We had to start him on IV fluids. We had to balloon splint his leg. We had to start him on some medicine to try and we were worried that he had a head injury. So we gave some medicine to try and reduce the intracranial pressure. And keep his blood pressure from going too high in case he was having a bleed inside his head. We were able to, we had a special brand new, instead of using the basket or the old litter, kind of the universal litter that most of the services used, it was really too big to easily get down in the pine trees. We had a special litter that Thompson had brought down in his knapsack, and you could construct it around the person by sliding some steel tongs under them, and then there were some set screws that you could just crank with your hands and tighten it around them, and then Velcro straps that you could put his head in it, and we put whatever we could around his neck to keep it stable. And I realized when we were ready to hoist him that there was no way the helicopter could get close enough to hoist where we had landed. So we walked out on a promontory that was kind of over the shale, and the helicopter came down as close as it could, and I swear it looked like the blades were, you know, like 2 or 3 feet away from the pine trees. This was actually a second helicopter because the first helicopter had to return to the base. And the lieutenant this time was Lieutenant Don Winchester. And Don got that helicopter right down so that he could see the pine boughs through the plexiglass where his feet were on the pedals. And Don was able to swing the helicopter so that the hoist cable actually came at us like a whip and somebody grabbed it. And then we hooked it to the we hooked it to an eye above the litter that we had put around this gentleman. And what we had to do in order to get clearance from the shale, we had to lift the litter above our heads. There were four of us, lifted it above our heads, and on the count of three, we swung it out over the chasm, and it swung out, and it missed the shale by, I would say, about 3 feet, and it kept going, and thanks to Don Winchester, he was able to keep the arc from going across the canyon and hitting the trees on the other side by flying up and then straight out, and actually made the hoist rope vertical instead of the arc that it was trying to create. It was an amazing piece of flying. And
that sounds like one of those we're going to make this work moments is what that sounded like. Yeah, that was pretty good.
I don't think you'd find much in the manuals about this.
Right.
And then Don, as he was leaving, said that Ron Simons was coming back to pick up the corpsman and I. And I said, Don, I said, this is probably going to be my last mission. And if you don't mind, I'm going to take 101 back with the sheriff's car instead of getting back on that helicopter.
Nice. Totally understandable.
So I've given you kind of the first day, last day scenarios. And
well, and Doc, could you say were you on a Pelican? What was the airframe that you guys were working with then?
It was the HH-52A, which is Sikorsky.
Yeah, the Sea Guard.
And it had the Sea Guard, right? Yeah. Nobody called it the Sea Guard, but that's what it was.
Yeah.
And it had two 750 horsepower GE engines, but they derated it to just 750 horsepower because they wanted longevity in the helicopter, and one of the engineers decided that if they lowered the amount of power that they would last longer. And it was a great machine, but it was a little underpowered, and the fuel consumption sometimes made missions hairy like this one, because it seemed like they were always a bit short on fuel, and there always seemed to be a problem with hurry up and get it done because we're going to run out of fuel.
Nothing changes. So, nothing changes ever. Nothing changes.
I don't know if the M65s are the same, but the MH65s are the same as far as fuel consumption, but it always was a problem and we always had to deal with it. Sometimes we had to strip the helicopter and take things out if we had a longer rescue mission, or if we knew we were going to have more than two victims of some kind of injury that we were going to have to take all at once. We sometimes had to leave the crewman back, and the co-pilot would work the hoist, and I would go down, and the corpsman would go down, but we wouldn't have an air crewman because we had to save on weight. So there was always problems with weight, fuel, and length of time on the scene. Those were always problems we had to deal with.
Yeah, and I fully believe that those weren't just manufactured like, well, this might be a problem and we're doing it by policy. It was really like, hey, this is a problem because we will legitimately fall out of the sky.
Right.
Yeah, that's
and that's what he told me when he said that they were low on fuel. He said he didn't want the helicopter to fall on my head.
Fair enough. Sounds good. See you back at the dock. Yeah. That's good.
I will tell you that I was so impressed with my training in the Coast Guard and what I learned that I wrote a book about all my rescues for those 2 years. And the book is called Rescues from the Sky. I wrote it under a pseudonym, Lee Walters, MD. And I promise your listeners that if they read the book, if they go to sleep reading it, I'll give them their money back.
Fair enough. Yeah, I'm looking at
just from what you've given us just in these two stories. I mean, my goodness, I'm dying for more. I know you've got, you know, some other exciting things, and
I'll just list some of the other stories. We had a rescue of a woman who had actually self-performed an abortion on a Russian submarine because she'd gotten pregnant, and her husband was actually, they hadn't seen each other for a year, and he was on another ship, so she was trying to hide the fact that she was pregnant.
Immaculate conception.
There's nothing like seeing the red star on the conning tower of a Russian submarine to kind of make you, and it was only like, you know, 20 miles off our coast, so it was very interesting. We also had a sailboat owner who had a heart attack in Half Moon Bay, and there were like 35 to 40 mile an hour winds, and he lashed the wheel before he passed out, and his wife was the only other one on the sailboat, and they were sailing towards a rocky shore, and we had to get on the sailboat with full sails and go down, and we almost got caught in the rigging, which was a bad issue, because once that happens, they're going to shear the cable, and it's going to come down on you.
There's so much bad about that story that you just told, too. Half Moon Bay, home of Mavericks, and on a 40-knot day, that's it's kicking over there. Yeah, that's going to be a good one.
And we also had a rescue of a Czech crewman who developed appendicitis 50 miles out at sea with a 50 mile an hour storm, and we actually got down to the boat, and I think it was Don Winchester again said, "Doc, we've got to leave. The weather's getting so bad that we won't be able to bring you back up to helicopter. So you're going to have to sit out the storm." And we had our surgical kit with us, and I'm going to leave it at that and not tell you how that one ends, because that's a chapter that's not only exciting but tense. So I'll just leave that one hanging.
Wow.
No, that's awesome, Doc. I'm looking at your website here, Rescues from the Sky by Lee Walters, MD. Do I get it right?
You got it right.
Awesome.
And so, it can be Amazon.com is the place to go for it.
Yeah, I'm going to post it up everywhere. You know what I love is that you here's the best thing I like about storytelling with the Coast Guard, right? Everyone tells, everyone's version of events always seems different for whatever reason. And you call it a factional work. I love it. I think that that's the best way to tell a story is how you remember it and how it affected you. So I'm excited.
Well, you know, I always wanted, as soon as I finished the Coast Guard, I wanted to write the book. And what I really kicked myself for is not keeping a log. I wish I had kept a log. So I really had to go back and spend time with some pilots and my corpsman and several of the officers that I worked under. I actually got to have dinner with three of the pilots that flew me down in South Carolina near the coast, and we had a great time. And the more beer they drank, the better the stories got.
I believe how it that. Works. Yeah. Well, yeah. With you mentioned one of the pilots you work with, Don Winchester, and I've read his bio before, and you definitely you were in at a time with a lot of aviation heroics. Not that much has changed, but there was a lot of stuff, a lot of new stuff going on back then.
I'll just mention one other story because it was so unusual. I also got involved in a hijacking of a 747 by two Bulgarians who hijacked a 737 out of Sacramento and landed in San Francisco and demanded $800,000 and a pilot to take them to Siberia. And it ended up with a shootout with the FBI, and people on the plane got shot, as well as the Bulgarian hijackers. And HM1 Thompson and I were, again, the triaging crew that took care of everyone who was hurt. And that was another day that was just not unexpected, and there was teamwork between the Coast Guard and the FBI, and it was really a learning experience for everybody concerned. And
this career is bananas, Lee. I mean, my goodness, they need to make a movie about some of these stories. These are just like the most crazy. I mean, I wouldn't even think the Coast Guard would. I mean, some of them, yes, but I mean, hijackers and, you know, 747s just going nose up. I mean, my goodness. Nuts.
Yeah, it was a really unusual experience, and I feel kind of blessed to have had it because I learned so much that when I went back to my residency, to be honest with you, my first year residency, I was a little bored.
Nice. That's what I like to hear right
imagine.
There.
Yep. Imagine so.
Well, for anybody out there, we got a lot of people that listen to the show that are considering joining the Coast Guard. And I would say that Doc's story is not a unique one. I think even to this day, he mentioned four or five different tales there, and maybe 50% of them had to do with a traditionally understood Coast Guard mission, and the rest are whatever we were called to respond to that day. And nothing's changed. That's just the way the Coast Guard works, and it's definitely it's unique in the federal government, probably unique in the entire world, but a very special service to be a part of. So I'll echo your sentiments there, Doc.
I think it may be one of the most misunderstood military services, because I think a lot of people have the concept that the Coast Guard, you know, takes care of life preservers and rules for boating and things like that, and they do patrols. But I don't think people realize the depth, breadth, and the severe conditions that the Coast Guard operates in. And no one has any idea of how serious and how life-threatening to the Coast Guard personnel their mission can be. And, Coast Guard was active in World War II. It was a fighting service then. But to have a mission of trying to save lives, to be honest with you, that's the most important thing that you can do, and that's why I became a physician. So for me, the Coast Guard was perfect.
I love it. It sounds like they gave you a hell of a foundation too for what came next. And I know that you're working on your next book right now, Contagion Chaser. What a great, what a perfect time for that one to come out. You got a date on that one, Doc?
I'm about 2 chapters away from finishing it.
Awesome.
And then I have to go through the publishing thing. So I would say it's probably a year away, but it's going to be about my infectious disease career. And I had some similar wild rides in that, probably not as exciting as far as the weather goes, but nonetheless, I've set it up so that it's a comparison with how CSIs work as far as gathering all the evidence and coming up with an unusual diagnosis and things that are not suspected by other people, infectious disease people work on. And so it's been as interesting a career as being in the Coast Guard for the 2 years, and I've learned a lot, and I just want to share what I learned with readers. So I'm looking forward to getting that one done.
I love it, Doc. What is the major league infectious disease? Like, if you were the one that would make you feel like you did on that first day in the Coast Guard, what's the one that should make you pucker a little bit?
Well, I think the ones that makes your heart flutter, kind of like in the Coast Guard, is when somebody comes in with meningitis.
Yeah.
And usually they're young and they're seriously ill, and you know that they can give it to other people. And so I do write about a case of meningitis that comes in the ER in an 18-year-old University of Wisconsin student, and how serious it is. I think the other thing that will be interesting in the book is I'm going to compare the HIV pandemic with the COVID pandemic in the afterword. And that's probably going to be interesting because both have affected our healthcare system in different mm-hmm. ways, but one was a little more acute than the other, but death rates were soaring when I went into infectious disease practice from HIV. And COVID has created the same issue. So I think a comparison between those two viral infections is going to be very interesting.
Interesting.
Get the book, guys. Get the book. I'm telling you, I think this is going to be a great one. I have not read it yet, full disclosure, but it is on my Amazon shopping cart and about to get checked out now. So Rescues from the Sky by Lee Walters, MD.com. We'll link it all over the sites that we've got. And Doc, we so much appreciate your time today. We appreciate your service and for supporting us and the National Coast Guard Museum. Stoked to read your book. Stoked to read the follow-up.
By the way, I am going to send a copy of the book to that museum. I'm just awesome. I was waiting for them to kind of reopen and get going again before I did. Do you know where they stand now?
Well, so I can't give you the monetary thing because I'm not sure of it, but I think things have been going well since COVID. So they've broken ground, still in the fundraising mission to be able to get to that final number. But they got public-private matching for donations. So if you guys don't, the more people that donate, the faster we get it done. The more people that are aware of it, the more people that can become plank owners. Plug for the museum, CoastGuardMuseum.org. Read all about it. Find out what's coming next, and be sure to sign up as a plank owner. I've got the plank owner certificate on my wall here, and I will say I'm proud to be one. You know, for starting that legacy for the service.
And by the way, I put my email address is and the address of the website is in the back of the book, and I'd love to get feedback from anyone in the Coast Guard who reads the book. I would love to get feedback, so I would applaud that. So that'd be great.
Awesome. So,
all right.
Yep. Hey guys, we will post all this up on the social media channels and the website. Thanks everybody for listening. Doc, thanks again. And any parting shots?
Thank you, Lee.
Semper Paratus.
Perfect. Awesome. Semper Paratus, everyone. Thanks again.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.